Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents 8 Survived, the harrowing story of the USS Flyer and the only downed World War II submariners to survive and evade capture, by Douglas A. Campbell. Narrated by Chris Montero. Chapter 1. Treacherous Passage. The sea was in a furious mood. Piled on its surface were great, gray waves, living monsters who could humble even the greatest warships. Yet the USS Flyer was but a submarine, at about 300 feet, one of the smaller vessels in the Navy. Even when submerged, it pitched and rolled like a slender twig. But inside Flyer were no ordinary sailors. They were submariners. Men, most of them quite young, selected from the ranks for their virtues of fearlessness and its companion trait, optimism. Their mood was bright. Despite the beastly roar and hiss of the sea above them, none believed that on this day his death was at hand. The Reaper might come later, when their boat reached the actual battle lines in this, the third year of World War II. And probably not then either, they thought. The momentum of the conflict had turned in their favor. There was a sense, pervasive on board, that destiny was with the Allies. Everyone expected to be around for the final victory. These were young men, many of them green, led by a handful of sailors creased by the experience of having survived at sea. Death was for someone else, the enemy, even on January 16, 1944, even on the Pacific Ocean, the greatest naval battleground in history, a place where tens of thousands of Americans had already died. But the men aboard the Flyer could not ignore the thrashing as she bucked and twisted. For the one young cowboy in the crew, it had to make him think rodeo bull. He and his mates joked uneasily about the sobriety of the welders who had built the submarine back in Groton, Connecticut. They had left Long Island Sound in the brand new boat on November 23, 1943, after several successful sea trials there. The smell of fresh paint still competed with the ever-present stink of diesel fuel as they steamed south and then passed through the Panama Canal. The crew enjoyed the stop in Hawaii, basking in the warmth of the island winter days before resuming their westward journey toward the naval hotspots of the Pacific. Now in these angry seas, they approached the atoll known as Midway, one of the Navy's refueling depots. Once beyond Midway, their first wartime patrol aboard Flyer would begin, and their record, distinguished or dreadful, would be tallied in tons of enemy shipping sunk. With young hearts and a sense of invincibility, they knew that the slamming of their submarine by the sea was only a tune-up for the coming combat, and they had no fear. Because it was daytime, Flyer was running deep, avoiding the worst that the ocean was offering, drawing electricity from its huge banks of storage batteries to run its motors. The night before, when the storm was no less fierce, they had surfaced to run the diesel engines that charged the batteries. Then the whole fury of a winter storm, with winds topping 40 knots, was sweeping the sea, plowing up huge, heaving waves in endless ranks across the submarine's path. Now, even beneath the surface, the 78 sailors aboard Flyer felt the surge from the storm-driven seas that had raced thousands of miles unimpeded by land. But they knew that soon they would get a break. The shelter of Midway was only hours away. Midway, where the Allies had won their first decisive battle of the war. Midway, a symbol of Allied destiny. Just after noon, Commander John Crowley heard his radar operator in the conning tower report contact with land. The blip on the radar screen showed a small speck about 15 miles away. Through his periscope, the skipper saw that while the seas were still running high, the storm above had eased. Winds were force 4, about 15 miles per hour, and occasional rain squalls came from the mostly overcast sky. Once in a while, a hole in the clouds let sunlight through, enough so that Flyer's navigator could get a sun sight with his sextant. Crowley, relying on the radar report of land, gave the order to steer due west, and by 1:15 p.m., he saw through his periscope the low group of islands that are the Midway Atoll, about 9 miles away. At 2 o'clock, Flyer was 2 miles south of the entrance to Midway's channel and was sitting on the surface, with Crowley on the bridge, feeling the breeze on his left cheek. A detail of sailors was stationed on the rear deck, prepared to help in the anchoring of the submarine when it reached the dock. 15 minutes later, Flyer's semaphore light flashed a signal to a tower on one of Midway's islands and got a reply, "Stand by for pilot." With the seas running high, it would be essential for a harbor pilot to steer Flyer through the inlet. Even in calm weather, the naval base would dispatch a pilot, so hazardous were the coral reefs that surrounded the little port. Crowley, who had been at sea most of the 13 years since he graduated from the Naval Academy, was no novice sailor. He had served as a junior officer on 2 submarines, and then had commanded the submarine S-28 before taking charge of Flyer. He had read the charts and the descriptions of Midway's channel, but he had never entered this port. Nautical charts are helpful, and a practiced eye can learn a lot from them. They show obstructions, depths, the placement of buoys that can be used to help navigate. But close to land, the seas are tricky. There are cross currents and the local effects of wind to be considered, and nothing helps navigate such waters more than local knowledge. So Crowley was relieved when the message came out from the tower on Sand Island, the larger of Midway's 2 big islands, that the pilot was on his way. As Flyer lay off the channel, waiting, crewmen who had no job for the moment headed for the crew quarters, where the bunks were stacked 6 high above the metal plate floor, and they lay down because standing in the rolling submarine was too tiring. There were more messages, more directions for Crowley. More port side to gunwale, south side submarine base dock. Pilot is underway now. More alongside herring at south side NOB dock. Standing behind a steel bulwark, looking north toward the channel, Crowley could see a small motor launch coming out from the islands, braving the big rolling seas that were lifting his own boat like a toy, and he noticed that a heavy groundswell was running in the channel, setting the launch steadily to the east, or his right. He told his crew to steam in a little closer to give the pilot's launch a shorter run. At about the same time, the skipper gave the order to switch to battery power and to stop the diesel engines, closing their air intake valves to avoid flooding by the surf, whose crests at times towered above Flyer's low-slung deck. This was a cautious move, a smart decision to avoid potential damage to the submarine's engines, nothing more. Earlier that day, Crowley had radioed Midway. Flyer was supposed to reach the atoll at 6:30, not long after sunrise, but heavy head seas had caused a delay. When he got Crowley's message, the commanding officer at Midway, Captain Joseph A. Connolly, ordered that a watch be kept of the channel. He wanted the pilot dispatched once Flyer was spotted. Strong southwest winds blew across Midway all morning, bringing with them blinding rain squalls and buffeting gusts of wind. Connolly knew that the pilot would have difficulty boarding Flyer if these conditions persisted. He was more concerned with winds from another direction, though. Northwest winds would set up a surge in the entrance channel, which ran north and south and could create a troublesome southerly current. In southwest winds and seas like these, which Connolly certainly considered rough, he had already seen submarines make the passage from the outside buoys, named 1 and 2, motoring due north through Brooks Channel to Goonie and Spit Islands, which are embraced by Sand Island to the west and Eastern Island, to reach the shelter of the lagoon, where the seas were normally kept calm by the coral reefs that surrounded Midway. Another squall passed over Sand Island about 1:30 p.m. while Connolly was inspecting the Midway Rest and Recuperation Center. He had not yet heard of any sightings of the approaching guest, Flyer, but when he returned to his office at 2 o'clock, he learned that Flyer was waiting outside the channel entrance and that the pilot was on his way out to greet the sub. A radio squawked in the office, and Connolly heard his operations officer and the island signal tower discussing Flyer's progress. First, it was 200 yards from the channel entrance. Then, curiously, it was 500 yards. Flyer was drifting away. There was no logical explanation other than the surging sea. Crowley stood at the bridge, his feet and knees compensating for the sideways roll of the submarine, his left cheek whipped by increasing winds. The hatch in the bridge floor that led down to the conning tower was open, and the skipper was in constant dialogue with his crew. Two officers shared the bridge with Crowley, and to the rear, the men of the anchoring detail waited for instructions, enjoying the bracing smell of the salt air, a refreshing change from the aroma of perspiration that, after a rough 4-day transit from Pearl Harbor, had begun to vie with the paint and diesel smells in the buttoned-up boat. Up in the channel, the little motor launch turned and hurried back toward the safety of the lagoon. Then Crowley saw a yard tug poke its bow out between Goonie and Spit Islands, and in minutes the tug was tossing in the same surf as Flyer. Someone on board was attempting to shout instructions through a megaphone, but the wind was screaming through the bridge and its superstructure, and the voices from the tug were swept away. The tug, about 1/3 the length of the submarine, made no effort to come up beside Flyer, as the motor launch could have. The seas were too rough for such large vessels to raft together. There was no way for the pilot to get aboard Flyer. The tug's semaphore flashed a signal to Crowley that confirmed this reality. "Follow me." The tug turned toward the open sea, swung completely to the right, and headed north between the channel markers. Crowley gave the orders to follow, and, like a dutiful guest, Flyer fell in behind the tug, about a half mile from the buoys, which the submarine passed in less than 10 minutes. The tugboat and the pilot were about 1,000 yards ahead, and Crowley called out course adjustments, attempting to steer his boat along the same path the tug was following. In order to keep a safe distance from the escort, he gave an order for 2/3 speed, or about 10 knots. The skipper was unaware of the local custom during rough weather. Captains familiar with this channel knew that in order to maintain steering in these conditions, it was necessary to steam at 15 knots. Any slower, and the surf would actually pass the ship's rudder, eliminating its control over the vessel's direction. In his ignorance of the local waters, Crowley's main concern was that Flyer not overtake the yard tug in front of him. With surf 20 feet or higher coming from the left, lifting the submarine and then dropping it in the following trough, he could not afford to get too close to another vessel. And just now, there was another hazard. A severe squall had blown up, and rain was pelting the channel all around the submarine. Blinding as a blizzard, the rain came just when navigation was most difficult, as Flyer reached the heavy groundswells in the channel. The first of the swells caught Flyer as it passed through the entrance buoys, and the boat went involuntarily into a leaning, diving turn to the left. Crowley called down into the conning tower hatch, "Course, 355 true!" The rudder responded, and the submarine began turning to the right. But now the next swell lifted the submarine's stern, and at the boat's slow speed, the wave overpowered the rudder. Flyer leaned to the left and dove to the right, well past the new compass course Crowley had ordered. The skipper called out for left rudder, then left full rudder, and slowly the boat seemed to respond, swinging rapidly to the left once more, well past the course needed to head up the channel center. In all the twisting mayhem brought on by the ground swells, and in the blindness of the passing squall, no one on the bridge seemed to notice how far to the right the submarine had traveled. It mattered little. For all the steering and attention to compass readings, the men aboard Flyer had lost control of their boat. The sea, not a sailor, was at the helm, and now drove Flyer clear of the channel, off into the reef-strewn surf line to the east. The men in their bunks in the rear of the submarine, just ahead of the forward engine room, learned of all this at about the same time Commander Crowley recognized his fate. They found themselves sprawled on the floor plates, thrown unceremoniously off their bunks in a heap of arms and legs. Scrambling to their feet on the tilting deck, they ran forward, past the mess hall and the galley, where pots, pans, dishes, coffee, and garbage were scattered across their path like debris from a tornado. "It must have been a collision," they yelled to each other as they hurried by the cramped little radio room, heading for the control room and hoping for an explanation for the gruesome grinding sound and the sudden stop. Up on the bridge, Crowley had the unwelcome answer. Flyer had run aground. The boat was in the midst of its second wild swing to the left when the unmistakable, jarring sensation of its keel striking the hard ocean floor vibrated up through the steel and telegraphed into Crowley's legs. Just as quickly, the next surge lifted the submarine high off the bottom, only to drop it again on solid ground, bringing the boat to a dead stop. Stopped, but not motionless. Each following swell lifted Flyer slightly, giving the skipper hope. "All ahead full," he ordered, hoping to bully the submarine forward and off the coral reef that his vessel now straddled. Flyer's two propellers, each with a diameter several feet taller than a man, dug their huge blades into the green surf. But despite the desperate straining of the motors, the boat would not budge. "Port stop! Left full rudder!" Crowley called down into the open hatch at his feet. He hoped that by using the power of the surf in combination with the starboard or right side motors, he could turn the boat and slip from the reef. His orders echoed down the tunnels of the submarine, relayed by men bracing themselves against the unnatural heaving of the submarine. Now an urgent message came back to Crowley from the control room, two levels below the bridge. The voice of one of two sailors in the maneuvering room, a cubbyhole tucked back between the rear engine room and the aft torpedo room where the electric motors were operated, had shouted through the control room intercom, "Fire!" In the control room, sailors quickly checked the dozens of brass and glass gauges and dials, looking for trouble. Nothing seemed out of order. The telephone system between cabins was working and the motors were running. Whatever the problems in the maneuvering room, Crowley had more immediate concerns. Someone else would take charge of the reported fire. The skipper had to wrest his boat from its perilous trap. Caught halfway across a reef, the submarine could get slammed broadside by a rogue wave. Even the surf that was now manhandling the boat could, in a wrong moment, roll Flyer over. Then the skipper and his 77 crewmen would be trapped, doomed to drown within sight of shore. Hoping to make the submarine more buoyant, Crowley ordered that water be drained from tanks in the sub's belly that were flooded to keep the boat floating at a desired level. And he kept trying to steer the seesawing Flyer out to sea. The starboard or right motors were racing forward while full power to the port or left motors was turning that propeller in reverse, the combined effect urging the sub as long as a football field to swing to the left. Each new swell lifted the sub, giving it a chance to move, and with each following trough, Flyer shuddered with the impact of the reef a few feet farther to the east. The skipper knew that to save the submarine, he must either skip free of the coral that was grinding into the hull or turn the boat completely around to face into the mountainous seas. If that turn could be made, even if Flyer did not escape the reef, she could drop anchor to hold the bow into the waves, thus overcoming the chance of a capsize. Crowley had been nudging Flyer thus for 20 minutes when a report on the maneuvering room fire reached him on the bridge. A large tool chest mounted on a wall had fallen to the deck from the jolt when the submarine grounded, and a screwdriver from it had landed so that it shorted out two electrical terminals. Sparks from that short had ignited some rags, and the two men in the maneuvering room were able to quickly extinguish the blaze. That was good news for the skipper, and now some more relief. The sub seemed to be turning in a favorable direction, heading southwest or into the surf, not quite in about phase from its original course, but promising nevertheless. Crowley decided to settle for what he had. He ordered that an anchor be set to keep Flyer from being driven further onto the reef. Seaman James Call, Clyde Gerber, and Kenneth Gwynn were on the anchor detail. They moved forward from the gun deck behind the bridge and began climbing down a steel ladder to the foredeck, along with George Banchero and Wait Daggy, the line handlers. Tagging along was Joseph Leah, a torpedo man who had been allowed on deck just to get some air. The foredeck of the submarine looked, from the base of the conning tower, like a long, large log. 1 minute it was naked as the bow was lifted by a wave, seawater cascading down the rounded sides. Then the bow plunged again, the deck covered in a swirling froth. As a lifeline, the sailors had only a flimsy fence on each side of the deck, comprising a single strand of cable supported by occasional posts. With small walls of green water from the onrushing surf breaking over Flyer's bow, the six men grabbed one or the other cable and started forward. Wading against the current of the surf as it raced around their thighs, they reached the forward gun mount, where the two lifelines joined a single strand leading to the submarine's bow and the anchor controls. The process of dropping the 2,200-pound anchor involved men on deck and men inside the submarine. Call carried a wrench to do his part of the work. The rest had their hands free to hold on to the cables. There were levers to be moved and gears to be turned once they reached the bow. Then the anchor chain would be allowed to run free, the weight of the anchor pulling the chain from the boat. Lowering the anchor required precision and clear communications in any situation. In this case, with the howl of the wind and the roar of the waves, it demanded unspeakable courage. The men knew when they climbed up the ladder in the conning tower and opened the hatch to the bridge that the risks were grave. As was typical of submariners, they went by habit. Most of them went without life preservers. There was a reason. When a submarine traveled on the surface, crewmen on deck had to be able, with only a moment's notice, to scamper below and seal the hatch above them should the captain order an emergency dive. A life belt caught on a piece of ship's hardware could leave a sailor stranded above the closed hatch, doomed. Do you risk getting tossed overboard without a flotation device, or getting snagged outside a diving sub by that device? On this detail, only one man, Banchero, had strapped a life belt around his waist. The other crewmen had made a deadly mistake. Two sailors, Leah and Call, had reached the anchor gear just short of the bow, and the others were somewhere behind them. In the roar of the storm, Leah and Call did not hear an officer on the deck call them back. Daggy and the others heard and began a retreat, leaving Leah standing on the starboard side of the lifeline opposite Call, who, poised to begin work, had one hand on the lifeline, the other holding the wrench. It was then that a huge green wave bore down on Flyer's bow, hitting both men before it hit the others, sweeping their feet out from under them. Leah held tight to the lifeline as the sea washed completely over him. When the water was gone, so was Call. "Man overboard!" Leah yelled, his voice riding the wind back to the bridge. The wave had swept Gerber overboard as well, and had thrown Daggy back to the bridge, where his head was slammed against the welded plate steel of the conning tower. Some part of the steel had slashed the side of his chest an inch deep, tore a jagged rip in his lower lip, cutting a vein, breaking off three teeth, and knocking four others loose. With his jaw probably broken, Daggy climbed to the bridge and down into the conning tower. A torrent of seawater came with him. As he passed them, his mates, Crowley among them, saw that his blue shirt was drenched with salt water and blood. Leah, having given the man overboard alarm, held tight to the lifeline and scanned the water for Call, whom he spotted in the surf, already many yards from the submarine, being driven away by the currents and waves. He had a hopeless look on his face, and as he treaded water, Call's arms were extended before him as if in a plea. Now Leah heard someone on the bridge calling for a volunteer to go into the water, and he headed aft. By the time he reached the bridge, Banchero had already stripped off most of his clothing, was wearing an inflated life belt, and was holding a cork life ring. Banchero made his way along the rear of the submarine and then jumped into the sea. He could see Gerber in the water, but not Kahl. He swam toward Gerber, who had no life belt. The thought of three men overboard weighed in Crowley's thinking, balanced against the safety of another 74 crewmen still on board the submarine, which now pivoted on the reef, swinging to the southeast and then back 50 compass degrees to the southwest, at the whim of the sea. The captain ordered the diesel engine started, but he could use them only for short periods. The roiling surf had stirred sand from the seabed, and this gritty water quickly fouled the cooling water needed by the engines. Moreover, Crowley could not use one of the four engines at all. Its exhaust valve had to be kept closed against the onslaught of seawater that, if it entered the valve's port, could flood Flyer. Everything had happened quickly aboard the Flyer. Ashore, it was only 2:30 p.m., 15 minutes after Flyer's first contact with the pilot boat, when Captain Connolly was told the Flyer was aground. He ordered his operations officer to have all the available tugs and the submarine rescue ship Macaw dispatched to help the submarine. Joined by another officer, Connolly then went to the small boat basin and boarded Macaw to participate in the salvage operation. Shortly after 3 o'clock, under a darkening sky, Macaw headed out Brooks Channel. Connolly saw that Flyer was about 400 feet east of the channel, headed south. Macaw's skipper, Lieutenant Commander P.W. Burton, took Macaw to the end of the channel and then dropped anchor. The boat swung into the wind, and Connolly stood at the bridge beside Burton, looking aft across Macaw's stern and the water between the ship and the submarine. Each time Flyer's bow rose from the sea, another huge green wall of surf slammed it down, one pounding leading to another. Connolly recalled the last time a sub had grounded at Midway. Scorpion had hit the reef on the opposite side of the channel 5 months earlier, just before the most severe waves of a storm lashed Midway. By getting a line to Scorpion, Connolly had been able to pull the sub to freedom. Just 2 weeks ago, Scorpion had returned to Midway, topping off her fuel tanks before beginning her fourth war patrol, proof that a grounding on these reefs need not be fatal. But Flyer faced a far graver situation, Connolly believed. If he didn't get a wire to Crowley soon, the surf might push Flyer sideways to the reef and roll the boat over. Should that happen, certainly the entire Flyer crew would die. Normally, Connolly could send a small boat from Macaw to Flyer with a cable that would be used to haul a heavier cable, and then an even heavier one, until the rescue ship and the submarine were connected by a wire strong enough to tow the Flyer to safety. But the roughness of the seas this time made the use of small boats too treacherous. Connolly saw the truth of this judgment just before 4 o'clock, with daylight running short, when a line-throwing gun shot a wire from Macaw to a 50-foot motor launch. The crew began hauling the line aboard, but the strength of the seas prevented the launch from making any headway, and at one point the boat nearly capsized. The men lost the wire, and it drifted away. Connolly, standing on the rear deck now, noticed that the tugs he had dispatched were having trouble with the seas as well. If the tugs could not operate, then he could expect disaster with the small launches. Just then, he noticed that the Macaw's engines were revving. He went to the bridge, where the skipper informed him that it was impossible to hold his position in these seas. The idea had been to anchor so that Macaw's stern swung east toward Flyer, and then use the ship's propellers to move the stern left and right, guiding the line that would be floated to the submarine, but that was not working. Connolly had another plan. He suggested that the skipper take the Macaw halfway up the channel where it could be turned around and then head back to sea, floating a line as it moved so that the line would drift eastward to Flyer. Commander Burton told Connolly that it would take only 10 minutes longer to go all the way back in to Midway's Basin. All right, let's go all the way in then.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?